wat kwa nuwara dus te wakwego. Tanya dahas kigon, then on zewa dahun sadache, unga huwen na hadiwa nodus, nene Aboriginal Voices, oska dewa nyawar oska, ne jota FM CFRC.
It is 6 o'clock and you're tuned to CFRC 101.9 FM. And we're broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Ontario, Canada. Ani Nichkiwank Dag Farquhar Dijnikaz Minwa Sean Story Esna Minwa and Ishnabi Nawewin. And Sean, it is gorgeous month of May, isn't it?
It has been gorgeous. As long as your bar for gorgeous isn't that high.
Oh, no. It is cool temperatures, and there's light rain on and off in different... Each week we've had a little tiny bit of rain. Perfect for watering the trees and the now new flowers coming up.
Definitely perfect for that, but it is chilly. Or it has been chilly.
That's all right.
But anyways.
Good.
So what's been
now,
up, Doug?
A couple of things. A couple of weeks ago, you were on assignment. And yeah. I just wanted to ask you a question or two about the hike that you did with others.
Yeah, I mean, it was a small hike. It was by no means a long one. It was in urban territory, I guess. Mm-hmm. Not exactly woods. So to speak, but it was along the...
A lot of trees there.
But still kind of urban-y.
Right.
And it was in the... I think it's called the Riverside Park. I've lived here so long, I don't really know what the name of the park is, but mm-hmm. I believe it's Riverside Park in Napanee.
Oh, and, right near the waterfalls there?
Yeah, just right near the waterfalls. We started up there at the top.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would be east of the train bridge.
Oh, right. Okay. Right at the falls. So, okay, good.
Well, yeah. So at the...
How far east did you go?
What do you mean?
Down to
That's the parking area.
Yeah, but when you walked the trail... Did you go all the way to the park at the other end under the bridge?
Well, yeah, you can go all the way on that pathway to the other bridge. And you can either go up and over that bridge or you can go under that bridge. And you walk all the way to the end of the dock, which, you know, is not very long. But then you walk up and through the park up to the water park and I guess do a loop, and we did that loop and came back down and through and got back to where it ended on that spot. So that was your end of the dock, and then you get on that dock and you walk all the way back. But
oh, okay.
You walk all the way back, you go underneath that same bridge, and you walk and walk. And then you got to go up that hill.
Mm-hmm.
So the hill is the hill is difficult.
But it gets you to the top of the falls, so you can stand back and say, I'm going to rest here a minute, or turn and go under bridge
you get
to your
to the
parking.
Top, and then you get back to your car and you get in and you drive home.
For a good cup of tea.
No real point in staying there. So that was that.
And did you have it? You know, you and I, during the pandemic, we went to do one of our shows, Aboriginal Voices shows, on the edge of that river. And that was fun. I really enjoyed that. But did you have any of the choir behind you in the water?
The ducks?
Yeah, the ducks and the geese?
Yeah, there was a few, I wouldn't say.
Oh,
a lot. I wouldn't say choir.
Oh, Well, remember when we were there and recording, we had a, you know, they would sort of follow us down a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, that was weird because we did that in the winter time, and the duck should have been gone south.
Yeah. Well, open water, they don't want to go anywhere. Why fly when you can stay?
I suppose, yeah. But generally they like to go south.
Mm. Yeah, lots of people do. All right, so that was good. Because a lot of the trails that we talk about, you know, some of them are a little difficult for footing, but the trail you said is perfect for walking for any age.
I would say that any age for that particular one. I don't know where they're going next week, but I don't know where they go after that, but I won't be gone to that one.
No, but this is organized, like a group of people just, here we go, somebody is in charge of where to go for the hike, and then you just let everybody know and they just sign up, or is this a club?
No, it's a group thing, so at the beginning of the year you sign up and you show up and you get an email and let you know where the hike is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so you show up. Well, like, it's not like required or anything like that. If you want to go, you go. If you don't, well, we have some that are in Belleville that tend to not want to go to the Napanee ones.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I know some communities have talked about doing this sort of thing, communities north of here. And actually, there's one in around Bancroft, just northwest of Bancroft. Mm-hmm. And they were wondering how they go about organizing it. So I'll tell them that they should listen to us on the 26th of May, and they'll learn a little bit.
Very little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not the one who organizes it. It's not me. I just participate.
You're supporting them.
I used to participate a lot, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't anymore.
Well, see, it turned out to be perfect because your field trip has been, now you're the field reporter for Aboriginal Voices as well as just the host.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. Now, anybody bring along snacks?
Oh, gosh, it's not that long.
Oh.
They do bring water, mm-hmm. like a thermos.
Right. I was wondering about snacks because, whenever I've taken hikes with different groups or just family members, I always make sure that I take along some of what I call GORP, but it's...
Yeah, it's not that long.
But it's just something in case somebody needs it. Yeah.
Well, they won't need it. It's only about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes hour 10, hour 15, but mostly average is an hour.
Right.
Which is just the right amount for people who aren't interested in movement, but aren't interested in, like, four-hour epic, hikes and stuff like that.
Good. I'm glad you did that. I one song comes to mind, though, after you say that, and maybe we could play that in a few minutes, called Shkoden. Digging Roots did that before, and Ashkodin is almost like the cadence of walking. Well, not really slowly like I do, but the cadence of walking. So if you hear the song, then think of being out on a good walking trail, something with sort of level, firm footing for you, and not something with rocks and water and mud. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you want to hear Skoden?
I desperately hate the mud.
No, I won't ask why.
Just don't care for it.
Okay.
Anyways, carry on.
Good. All right. Well, we'll do Skoden right now and by Digging Roots, and then we'll be back to have a chat.
All right.
It can't slow down, can't sit still. Can I get some peace of mind? It can't slow down, can't sit still. Can I get some peace of mind?
Live music fans, get ready. Spring Reverb returns for its fifth edition May 28th through the 31st in downtown Kingston, Ontario, and CFRC is thrilled to be part of the action. Over 4 days, you can catch live music panels, workshops, and see what makes the Kingston music scene tick. Get ready for acts like Bedouin Soundclash, The Dirty Nil, Hot Garbage, By Divine Rights, Slaves of Spanky, Pony Girl, Tanya Iyer, Golden Feather, and so much more. Also, make sure to check out all the free panels, workshops, a merch market, and the first ever Cataraqui Punk Rock Flea Market. For more information on the lineup and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com or Spring Reverb YGK on socials. See you there.
Hey, punk. Do you like weird stuff made by real human artists? Want to know where to find taxidermy, patches, tattoos, paintings, stickers, zines, felted pieces, repurposed clothing, jewelry, plushies, hand illustrations, mutual aid foraging information, local preserves, buttons, cards, crochet, and punk performances all under one roof? Come check out the first ever Cataraqui Punk Rock Flea Market on Saturday, May 30th from 1 till 3 at the Broom Factory as part of Spring Reverb. CFRC DJs will be spinning tunes in between sets by the Meringues and Havana Syndrome. With nearly 30 vendors indoors and outdoors, you're sure to find something that speaks to your strange side.
Hey, hey, hey! You want to kick the summer heat and get a nice treat? Don't hesitate to make a date to visit Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen food to prepare at home. Pop into the shop Monday through Sunday between 8 to 6 at 204 Berry Street. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at Old Farm FF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
Your library, your story. At the Kingston Frontenac Public Library, books are just the beginning. A library card starts a lifelong adventure, connecting you to everything you need to inspire learning, creativity, and fun. With 16 locations and plenty of online services, using your library has never been easier. Study in a quiet space, meet friends and learn new things, or explore the world through a magazine or a museum pass. Become a part of our story. Visit your local library branch or find us online at kfpl.ca.
Well, I hope you do get to go to the library. I was at the library today, just the one in Snorrington, in Sunbury, Ontario. And yeah, it's not a very big spot, but boy, they're very helpful. Actually, I've been going back and forth a number of times now to get books for Aboriginal Voices so that I have, you know, books to share with you, our listeners, or to share with Sean. And sometimes they've been making suggestions, and the best suggestion was one I did, I think in February. It was a book about Mi'kmaq basket making. And I thought, nobody's going to be wanting this book out of the library right now, so I could borrow it for 2 weeks. And sure enough, they said, you can have it for 3 weeks. And I started looking through it. I think I mentioned this on the air. The basket, the photographs are absolutely spectacular. They show the work that the various artists have done. And they're all East Coast basket makers. And I looked, I turned to one basket and I said, this looks familiar, you know. And I mean, we're talking in 2026, I'm looking at it. And, but I was going back to 1970s when I was studying at Dalhousie University, and I ended up meeting some people, and one of the fellas in the program that I was studying, he lived in the sort of the Digby area, but he said just a little bit east of Digby, and so I looked in and I saw the name of the basket maker, Frank Muse, and I thought, well, that's odd. That's, you know, the fellow I studied, he was in my class, and his name was Mike Muse. And looks very similar, you know, and I thought, this is something. So then I got looking into it more, and I found out that, Mike Muse is the brother of Frank Muse. And Frank Muse, when I met him, was the chief of the Bear River First Nation in Nova Scotia. Right near, it's in the Annapolis Valley. So, yeah, they're really quite a small world when you go to your little public library and you get a book, and all of a sudden there's somebody in there that you'd met along the way. Now, I didn't know he was a basket maker then, but I knew he was, like his father and his grandfather, a really good birch bark canoe maker. So, because he showed me the one that his grandfather made, and he showed me one he had made. And I thought, this is fantastic. Yeah, just too bad I didn't say, can we try it out? But it wasn't the best time of the year to get out on the water. Anyway, it's really interesting. And I shared the book with family members, and so that's really good. Then along comes this notice that I received, and there is a basket-making group in Portland, Ontario. And this the 10th anniversary meeting that they have. And so I thought, that would be really great to go to. But I missed the date by the time I received everything and got things settled. But I've been talking with the person who's organized it, and she might even come in to Aboriginal Voices and share with us a little bit about basket making and the people that they have in the area. She's an Algonquin, a member of the Algonquin First Nation, so here in the area. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Now, the music that I had there was Shkoden, and it was done by Digging Roots. And, you know, you've heard Digging Roots in the past here on Aboriginal Voices, so I'm glad we got to hear that one. I always love when Raven gets started and he comes up with really good ideas. But I just have to tell you, Raven and Shoshana, their son is now in his 20s, and he is also a musician, and it seems that he's following in his parents' footsteps. So could be fun. I'm looking forward to sitting down with all three of them and chatting. And I'll listen to the parents first, and then we'll kind of go sideways and talk to the young fellow and see what he's into. They came to Kingston a number of times over the past years. So anyway, so I have new music. Eric Alper has been sending Aboriginal Voices a number of pieces of music, or actually he's highlighting a number of pieces of music for artists. And I told him I'm just interested in Indigenous artists, and that's all he sends us. And some new music that we get here often is either sent from Eric as a publicist or from Beth Cavanaugh. And she's connected with Amanda Rayomes and Shoshana Kish's publishing company. So this one, Alicia Cayley is her name, and she's Algonquin from the Ottawa area, and she's had a couple of songs out, but this one is a brand new song, just sent to us in early May, and so we're going to air it tonight for your listening. But if you like some of what her work is, then let me know at aboriginalvoices@cfrc.ca. And I will then let Eric know and maybe pass it on, and we'll try and arrange an interview. That's only if you request it. So I was just thinking, too, what genre she has. And, you know, what often you can't figure out which one you want to put them in. But some of her work is pop and R&B, but also blues and soul. So the two pieces I have tonight, I'm going to share with you and have some fun with it. First, I mentioned that she is the singer-songwriter from Algonquin Nations, and she resides in Ottawa. That's kind of nice. And she did a Bachelor of Music at Carleton University, and she specialized in classical voice and popular style songwriting. And that gave her the foundation of her artistry for what she has now. She's been able to work with Crystal Schwanigan. And Crystal has her own, I've lost where it is now, sorry. But Crystal has her own company. And so she's now helping some other First Nations musicians get started or get going, and then and publicizing them. So I'm going to, I guess New Beginnings is, it's a beginning of something new for Alyssa Cayley. This is her song that she wrote that really has her not... She troubled with the words that she was trying to use, and, you know, start over, you know, and she came up with this one called New Beginnings. So we'll play that one first, and then the other one following, Don't Break My Heart. So I think both of them have something to do with her feelings and how she goes about dealing with them is put it into music. So here we go.
I'm here need someone real. I need someone close who can feel what I feel. I'm tired of waiting, I'm suffocating. I'm always waiting for a love I can feel. Mm-hmm. Hey. This don't serve me, shouldn't have to worry. Just a little wet day. New beginnings, new beginnings.
Somebody else. I never knew why my dreams would come true, and my heart it finally fell. This passion, this feeling, the beat in my chest, it's taken so long to find you. And now that you're with me, I won't let you go. There's nothing that I will not do. Please don't you break my heartbreak. My heart can't take 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 heartbreak. Please don't you break my heart. Please don't you break my heart. Please don't you break my heart. Please don't go breaking.
you break my heart.
The following story may be difficult for some of our listeners to hear. If you need support, please reach out to your local mental health crisis line. Additional resources can be found at adaytolisten.ca. This is A Day to Listen 2024 with your host, Kim Wheeler.
Sagu Anin, my name is Kim Wheeler, and this is A Day to Listen. Each year, the Gord Downey and Cheney Wenjack Fund partner with Bell Media to bring you conversations with Indigenous movers and shakers, thinkers and doers, motivators, and those who inspire. My conversation on this episode is with the amazing Tina Keeper. Tina was the first Indigenous woman to play the lead in a prime time drama. The show is still incredibly popular today, and if you guessed North of 60, give yourself a pat on the back. Tina was recently named to the Order of Canada, and after this interview, you'll know why. This is my conversation with Tina Keeper.
Anse, Tina Keeper in Indigenous. Hello, everybody. I'm Tina Keeper, and I am from Norrie House Cree Nation on my father's side. That's where my membership is, and citizenship is with Norrie House Cree Nation, top of Lake Winnipeg, Treaty 5. My father was Joe Keeper. And on my mother's side, I'm from Muskrat Dam First Nation in Treaty 9. My late mother was Phyllis Beardy.
You have had a long career in film and television, but you weren't always an actor. In fact, we first met when we were both really young. I was in junior high school. You were my student teacher.
So, yes, I was 19 years old. I was actually part of a program for Indigenous women put on by the Community Education Development Association here in Winnipeg. And at the time, the executive director was Greg Selinger, who would then later become a premier in Manitoba. And I ended up working with them, and I had the good fortune to be placed in your school. It was a middle school, and I had an office, and I had a supervisor who would come in and check on me about once every 2 weeks. And he basically said, okay, do something here, create relationships with the students, the teachers, and see how it goes. I was like, okay. So that's how that job went. I ended up becoming a sub for one of the teachers on a regular basis. And I did the programming, after school programming is what I focused on. So that was our girls club we had.
Yep.
And I had so much fun with that. There was an art teacher at the school then. So the art teacher used to help me. You know, remember, we would do batik and kind of all these different artsy things. And then in the winter, we would do our snowshoeing. All these activities that I felt like, it was fun. I felt like a combination of my art teacher and my dad, because my dad always took us out every weekend when we were growing up. We moved to the city when I was 5. And then it was like his mission. Every weekend, we would do different things. So we all learned how to snowshoe and cross-country ski. My father, for sure, I could feel it in the winter where you really miss the outdoors. And my mother in the summer, you know, because they were both from the north. So we spent a lot of time doing these activities. So that's all I tried to do, was pass on these things.
You made a real big impact on not just me, but I think other young Indigenous girls in that school. When you were there, when you were running the girls club, you know, you were a role model back then for us. But we didn't have that word role model. We just knew that Tina Keeper was like this really cool young woman who came to hang out with us, and we could talk to you about anything. You were never judgmental. You were very open. You were very kind. You were very caring. For me, growing up in a white family, because I was adopted out, that was really important to me. It was really important to me to have someone like you around. And while it was a very short time, I remembered you my entire life. And then the next time I saw you, you were on my television. You were on my television in North of 60. And I was like, that girl was my student teacher. Yeah. How did you change your career path from teaching to acting?
Well, by the time, at 19, by the time I was, we'd met, I was already part of the Indian and Métis Friendship Center in Winnipeg. You know, was such a dynamic place at that time when I was growing up. My family were very much a part of that center. And there was a youth group there that did theater. So that's how I got involved. So I was already involved with that theater group. And the theater group, were made up of young, sort of the first wave. I've always called us the first wave of indigenous, urban youth, right? We were really impacted, for those of us that, grew up in our families. Like, I was so fortunate, and others were as well, to have, role models, too, that were... Ojig was one of my parents' friends, as we were growing up, when we lived up north, they lived there too. And her husband worked with my dad. The other person was Norval Morso. He was a friend of our extended family. He would come and stay at our place when he was in the city. So all these people that were just extraordinary. My father introduced us to writing at that time. Like, by the time I was 17, Frantz Fanon, the works of, James Baldwin and Alice Walker and Maya Angelou, all of that was very much a part of my younger years. People that came from oppression and that were also creating glorious works of art. And I think that had the biggest impact on me. I would say probably Ojig had the largest impact on me, in that I just felt that I could be an artist too. Like, I could create work. And from the time I was very young, from the time I was growing up, we lived in Cedar Lake, which was, there was a community there that was being forcibly moved because of the hydro impacts. So my father was working with them because my father spoke Cree and could read and write English, so he could deal with all of the materials that were coming in from hydro and the province of Manitoba and the government of Canada. They hired him to work with them, and he documented that process, which later became the basis of a large claim for them, in terms of their flooding by hydro. So we actually lived there when the community was forcibly moved. My father said that community was located on one of the top marshlands in North America. He said that the people there were so kind and so gentle. He said, I was really surprised. I'd never met people so gentle. And he said, and I realized they'd always had an abundance of food. Like, they didn't ever have to worry about starvation. I kind of grew up with this young life of being really impacted by people that were really significant in how I thought about the world. And the other person, of course, was my mother, who grew up in a very remote, isolated place as well. And her grandfather was Chief Samson Beardy, who signed the addendum to Treaty 9. So she was the first daughter of the first son. So she had a very special relationship to her grandfather, Samson. My mother, she taught us how to bead. Like, that's how I learned how to bead, which was another thing we used to do when I was at the school with you. So I learned how to bead and do, make mukluks and belts and bags. And, I did learn how to do all that leather work and bead work when I was a little girl, and make fishnets, all these things. And did go blueberry picking and fillet fish. We'd go out to fish camp. So even though we moved to the city, when I was five, my mother had told me at the, last years of her life, probably maybe the second last year of her life, that the reason we moved to the city when I was this age. She said, with the boys, because I have older brothers, she said, with the boys, I didn't really think of it. It wasn't until you were turning school age that I realized they're going to come and take the kids for residential school, like if we stay on the reserve. Mm-hmm. And she said, and I just told your dad, like the moment I had that thought, I told your dad we're moving to the city. She said, because I didn't want kids to have to go. And her parents, her father had, in his last days of his life, had apologized to her for letting them go. He said, I should have hid you kids in the bush. I shouldn't have let you go. But, you know, the RCMP had been arresting people when her generation was going. So, you know, that really played a big part in our life, you know, the residential school impacts. And so that was what we did. My mom said she just literally told you, my dad, you're quitting, you're getting another job. So he actually got a job where he could kind of still do work with the community. So that's why we ended up in the city. And I remember so well, like I remember seeing Barbies for the first time. I remember being on a swing set, like in a schoolyard. I remember being called a name. I remember like being fascinated by the streets, you know, that they were like straight and there was cement and everything was in order. But my mother was very committed to community development, like not that word per se. She would never, ever have used that word. She was very old style. Like my mother's first language wasn't English. She would say, you know, you have to take care of the people in the community. You have to take care of the people that are weak or can't take care of themselves. Like that's our job. And so I started volunteering at what is now the West Broadway Optimist Center. I started volunteering with my mom when she was volunteering there. I was 14. So that's where I started. Like I started volunteering and then I volunteered at Stella Mission. And I just always ran these kids clubs. My mom was one of the founding members of Agape Food Kitchen.
Wow.
The Harvest, the food bank. That was another one of my first jobs too. So I just had this early life that was really full of, you know, full of energy, very full of art. Like I loved art. I loved artistry. I loved creation. I loved thought. And I loved people. Like, you know, my mother had that. And so that's sort of where it all began. And I ended up going to this theater group. We had a theater group with like Jim Compton was part of it. Errol Canistino, who ended up, you know, also on the show. Allison Dubois, Kathy Menard, all these like, you know, really cool people. My sister Joy, these brothers, they were the Moore brothers, M-O-A-R. They were from Barron's River. And we had a theater group. I'm rambling on here. I'm sorry.
No. I'm fascinated.
Going down memory lane.
Like I love this history of both Indigenous theater in Canada as well as all the things that your parents did.
There's this really sophisticated era, I think, that has never been brought forward. Like I don't think that people understand the level of commitment that they had in terms of their own sense of self-determination. My father was part of that group too, where they created the Manitoba Indian Brotherhood, the National Indian Brotherhood. Like there was this whole body of people across the country that were creating these organizations because prior to 1951, they weren't allowed to hire lawyers. They weren't allowed to have post-secondary education, right? By the time 51 happened, you had this group of people that were very, very committed towards creating organizations. And it was for justice. It was for their rights. The idea that the wealth of this country is based on our land, our resources. We never gave up our desire to have a good life and to take care of our families in our own land. You know, that is, it's that basic. You know, when I hear about like First Nations, like for instance, right now where they're fighting with the federal government around this money for the graves in the residential school areas. And I think, you know, that's our money. That's our money this federal government is built on. This wealth of this country is built on our wealth. We shouldn't even be asking for the money. This is something I think that is so important for us to remember as First Nations, our Indigenous people, I guess as Indigenous nations, is that there is no way that we should be the poorest people in this land. You know, there is no way that there should be homeless shelters with Cree names or Indigenous names, you know, like that is ridiculous. This is our land. These are our resources. You know, what has happened is that this country, you know, through their colonial practices, have tried to destroy the people in numerous ways. They undermine our people. They undermine our authority for our own people. And right now, I think that we are in a place where we should be in a recovery. And that recovery should not have a dollar cap on it. That recovery and reconciliation should be the federal government and the provincial governments walking hand in hand with us towards whatever innovative practices we need to regain recovery. Like, because the fact that we have so many people that have broken lives, that is a direct relationship to those policies. And I always feel like I've been so fortunate to have my family intact because both of my grandparents, sets of grandparents, and both of my parents, like they grew up on the land, especially on my mother's side. They weren't, they didn't have a store in the community. They didn't have a white church. They didn't have, you know, there was a church, but it was built by the people. They ran it themselves. Like, so there wasn't this sense that there was an external authority. That people still took care of things in their own way. They didn't speak English. My grandparents never went to residential school and my external family. So even in that, like even in the way they related to me as a child, they were very affectionate. You know, like that was one thing I could see, which was really broken by residential schools. Like my mother wasn't affectionate to me as a child, but my grandparents, my grandmothers, who would be like my great aunts, like those would be called your grandmothers, like they treated us like babies and we were like 8 or 9 years old, you know. And my grandmother would say, oh, come on in. She'd say, lay down, listen to the rain, you know, when we were back home.
Mm-hmm.
I was like 8 years old. I'm going to have to go lay down for a little nap and listen to the rain. It was so cute. Or 9, right? And they'd come and they'd hold you and kiss you and hold you like. So even that, like I thought the whole physical thing had been so distorted through residential schools. So that even like just something as simple as a hug, you know, kiss on the hand or a kiss on the head, those things which were so natural and so loving, those have all been taken away too, right? You know, my life was really focused on being part of an effort towards bringing a truth back or something like that. Sometimes I talk about it as a wave or like a era, but it really was who we were as, you know, as Cree people, as Indigenous people.
Yeah, you just had all these incredible role models around you. And it wasn't like they were trying to be role models. They were just living their lives and doing their thing and embracing what they were passionate about and not taking no for an answer.
Yes. Even though I'm getting old, like I'm like getting so old and I feel like I'm just beginning. Like I just feel like there's so much work to do still.
You've done so much already. Like all the work you've done in community, the work you've done in film and television. We haven't even talked about your political career yet, where you were a member of the Legislative Assembly of Manitoba.
Well, I was a member of Parliament.
Oh, you were a member of Parliament?
Federal, yeah. Manitoba, MP, like a federal
Manitoba MP. What was it like for you being one of very few Indigenous people in the...
Yeah, so I was only the second First Nation woman to be elected into the House at the federal level. And I think that the other members that... So there was Ethel Blondin before myself. Nancy Kerouac was still there when I was there. She's Inuit. Prior members were also Cecil Keeper, who was my father's cousin. So there's been two keepers. And then Dr. Wilton Littlechild, you know, who is also one of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissioners. I think he was also the first lawyer in Canada. Yes, there wasn't many. Like, literally, I might have been the fifth or sixth First Nation person to be in the House. Dr. Wilton Littlechild had been our Aboriginal legal resource because there wasn't even lawyers in the House that understood Aboriginal law. So when I was an MP, one of the things that I experienced was I was trying to, you know, we're all trying to work on Jordan's principle. You know, I did a private member's bill on Jordan's principle, like using a framework that we have a treaty right to health, that there should be a fiduciary obligation with the federal government for health to First Nations, you know, under a First Nations Health Act. I was able to work with Dr. Willie Littlechild to table my private member's bill on the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People at the same time that they were like tabling UNDRIP in Switzerland. The other thing, of course, was the IRS compensation settlement agreement had come during the time I was there. You know, I had to speak to that in the House. And like my father said to me when I got elected, you know, my girl, go and represent our people. Like Canadians have all those other people to represent. Work for our people there. And just remember, you know, change may not happen right away, but, you know, say what you need to say, get it on the record. And look to who's been there before you. Like, because, you know, like say John Tutusis, he came there in 1943 talking about the residential schools. You know, that was the late Gordon's father. And John had been a friend of my father's. So, like, I was able to have, you know, people like Phil Fontaine was there, you know, and, you know, Ovid had come. You know, these were peers of, like, of my father's, right? So I was able to have all these people say, look at this, look at that, say this in the House. You know, look at this legislation, you know, and we had an office in Seguin. Like, so we had a First Nations office. We're the only one in Canada. We were able to like work with, you know, survivors from across the country that were doing their common experience payment. I mean, it was a great, honorable, like I felt so honored and so privileged to be able to do that work. I was able to go meet with people in the, you know, in the all the communities and be there the first time they ever had an MP in their community. It was a great honor. I loved it so much.
All this incredible work that you've done, the experiences that you've had, and the people who have helped form you, how does that all relate to the work that you do now?
Oh, yeah. So as a producer, Kissed Again Pictures came out of it was like a fork in the road one time, and I had been offered a job that I felt was very important, that I was really thrilled to have been offered. But at the same time, I was asked to create a film company to manage a project that APTN was piloting. I really wanted to take the job, and I didn't know what to do. Then they came back with a second offer, and then they came back with a third offer. And then I had this dream that I was in this little garden. The next day, my cousin, who is from the north, but he lives in New York, and he comes and he flies through Winnipeg to go work as a nurse up north. So we were having dinner, and I said, I have these two offers. I don't know what to do. I had this dream last night, and I was in this little garden, and I don't garden in real life, so I can't stand it. I don't do it, but I was really happy in this little garden. And I said, I don't know what to do. And he said, honey, you just need to stay in your garden. Once he said that, I knew, like, I need to do this TV project. And turning down that other project was like that other job was so difficult. But that's when I started Kistagan. So Kistagan means garden, to garden in Cree. And now I feel like that work, I kind of like sort of like danced around it, you know, for a long time, because I always thought I want to go back to politics. And when my kids were older, I really feel like one of the things that I find so thrilling about the work is that I can make opportunities for people. Like, I have relationships with people, you know, especially here in Manitoba, that are people that are in the unions, people that are decision makers, that can work with us to help, like, really create a viable future for Indigenous people in this industry. And I don't think that I ever really felt that before. Like, it felt like they were kind of like one-offs, you know, like, you could work on this project, but you're not going to, which is what a lot of Indigenous people in the industry have said, you know, like, I get hired for this one project, but then nobody will hire me again. So I feel like, no, we're like change. We have an opportunity to change the industry. We have an opportunity to work with them, not just for Indigenous people on Indigenous projects, but Indigenous people like embedded in the industry, and they can create their future in the industry. So I feel that this is a real opportunity. This is something that's been placed in front of us. The show is doing so good. You know, we've been number one on our first two seasons. We have our third season that we just finished shooting.
The show you're talking about is Acting Good.
Acting Good, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to be part of building that industry here. Like, I want to do another show. I want to bring another show to Manitoba. And I want to bring, you know, writers here producing their stuff. I have a good network and it can benefit people. I want to be able to use my resources and my networks, you know, in terms of bringing on actors or bringing on talent or writers or connecting producers together. Like, however that is, I want to offer this up so people can have it and it becomes part of their opportunities, you know, moving forward. Because that's what I feel like I have right now. Like, I have that and I can give that. And what I'm finding is that people love our stories. They love listening to our stuff. They love watching our stuff. And we do succeed because that's who we are.
What a powerhouse Tina Keeper is. I still consider her one of my role models. Tina currently produces and acts in the hit TV show, Acting Good. Season 3 should be out this fall on CTV Comedy. Want to hear more great conversations with Indigenous icons like Tina? Check them out.